Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for September the 15th, 2019. Yes, halfway through the month of September already. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall onto the State House and all the way up to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, I got to tell you, I finally made it out to Wrigley Field on Friday, and I think I saw...
Oh, you did better than I had
pretty
this
much
season.
Pretty much a season's worth of runs in one game.
Yeah, you picked quite the game, huh?
Wow, it was fantastic.
What Two were your, days in a row.
What were your emotions like after the top of the first?
It was 4-0, and it's Lester pitching, and it's like, ah, come on. But I will tell you, the wind was blowing out so fierce that I actually said the over or under is going to be 25.
Wow. You really said that?
I really said that.
Before the four run top of the
yes,
first?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, good for you.
And of course it was 17-8. but oh, what a game. And truly it was like virtually anything that got up high enough in the air was going to take off. I love games like that where it's stress-free, you know. You really don't have to worry too much about the outcome. And now, you know, I was thinking here it's football season. They score 17 on Friday. They score 14 on Saturday. They're hitting football scores.
Yeah, hopefully the Bears can feed off of some of that offensive juju, too, because, you know, they need it.
And I don't know what to think today.
I feel like a lot of Bears fans feel that way today. I mean, this is kind of a very tense morning. You know, it's only week two, but if you start the season 0-2, I mean, all that anticipation of this year kind of goes out the window, and now you're just trying to put bubble gum and tape to the rest of this year.
Yeah, and of course, you know, as you noted, Joe, in the sports with Vic Fangio, it's like, you know, does he know the Bears too well?
Right. See, a lot of people were afraid of that coming into today's game, but I still feel like the Bears are too talented to just allow that to happen. I mean, it is still the NFL. I mean, guys have game plans. They understand what their opponent is heading into it, that Vic Fangio...
We are who you thought we were.
Yeah, right. Imagine seeing that. But I don't know. It seems like a lot of people were saying this week that all you have to do is alter the playbook offensively, even just a little bit, to create that just slight bit of mystery of, okay, will they still go this way in a certain route? Or, you know, just a slight change to alter the system.
Yeah, maybe like running the ball.
How about it,
huh? That might be a slight change.
What a crazy concept. We'll see if it pays out.
Well, it was so frustrating, obviously, that first game. And I think even then the Cubs scored more runs than the Bears scored points on that game. That
oh, total.
Game. And it's just frustrating. Just very frustrating. But I wore orange today. You know, it's good luck colors. I thought about wearing my Hawks jersey to celebrate the training camp festival going on. But then when I saw that the temperatures were going to be in the mid-80s later today, I thought, it's a little early to start getting the sweater on today. But
quite an unseasonable week of middle September we've had, though. It's been nice, though.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's the weather's been beautiful. And I even this morning I said, you know, I suppose we were kind of due for this. But I was looking at the radar, and it looks like, you know, things are starting to move out in the northwest suburbs a bit. So
I want to add to this, though, despite the fact that we have a flash flood watch that runs through 10 this morning, Rick, there are some warnings posted, some flood warnings for various areas. For instance, Boone County until later this morning, until 11 o'clock tomorrow night for Winnebago County, and 4 p.m. tomorrow for Ogle County. So there are flood warnings in effect for some of the outlying.
That'd be the Rock River, probably.
Yes, yes, right. And just received word a few moments ago that they're hoping that the Des Plaines River will crest today. So we'll keep an eye on that. But the flash flood watch is in effect until 10 o'clock this morning. Cook, DeKalb, DuPage, Kane, Lee, and Ogle counties. The rain should be moving out later on. Although, as you indicated, you know, we were looking at the radar together, and there were some pretty intense things out there by the Quad Cities. So we'll see where this goes.
Yeah. Yep. And, well, you know, good day to stay in and watch some football, and hopefully they'll be able to get the Cubs game going.
We've got all kinds of sports going on today.
Right.
Yeah, it's a jam-packed day.
And, well, and then tomorrow is the Hawks' first preseason game.
Right. How about that?
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, we're not rushing the year too much, are
no.
we? We're not moving too fast here. But,
well, I mean, you think about it. It's, what, 3 weeks away from the opener in
yes.
Prague?
Yes.
Less than that now?
Are you going to that one?
I'm not able to make that trip, no. Apparently the company couldn't expense that one for
that
me.
That is one of the neatest places I have ever been.
Are you going?
No, I wish. No, but Prague is one cool city, I can tell you.
Maybe we should have planned it better and done the show.
We could have done Prague, the show there.
You know?
Yeah, avid Hawks fan that you are.
I thought about going, honestly, but it just, scheduling doesn't work. And because
that's always the case.
That's a place I truly would love to see.
It's awesome. It's just awesome.
Well, I am so ready for the season to start too. Just, but it's I can't keep my eyes away from baseball, and
especially with the Cubs, the way they're hitting. Wow.
Well, and you know, you look at the wild card standings, and we're 1.5 games back of the Nationals for the top wild card spot.
Milwaukee right behind there.
Milwaukee right behind us, one game. But then, you know, and that's the trouble when the Cardinals are playing the Brewers. Mm-hmm. Who do you root for?
Right.
As long as we win, then I'd say, you know what? Then let the Brewers win.
Yeah, it's one of those things where maybe let Milwaukee win game one.
Yeah, split it,
and
right.
Let the Cardinals take the past couple of games. But you know, this time frame right now and April are the two best pockets for sports, I always say, because you got baseball winding down, you got pennant races, you've got football in full swing, you've got college football, and then, oh yeah, hockey's beginning too.
Oh, by the way, yeah. Yes.
And then April, and then it's kind of vice versa. You know, you got your March Madness winding down, and hockey and basketball playoffs, and then baseball kicks up. I mean, those two pockets are the best in sports, in my opinion.
Well, you mentioned college football, and you know that there weren't any real big great matchups yesterday. It was one of those weird quirks in the schedule.
The best game was probably Iowa-Iowa State, and you had to wait a 3.5-hour rain delay for it.
So they went out and got sandwiches for the Iowa players at one point in the second quarter, 2-hour rain delay. Thunderstorm delay, they went out for sandwiches for the players. Because I guess the whole game, even though they shortened the halftime, it was over 5.5 hours, I think, was how long it took for that. So, I got to think down in Champaign, the days are numbered for Lovie Smith.
How about it? Man, I mean, just a couple of years ago, it was like, this is kind of cool. You know, a nice turnaround for the Illini football program, you know, create a lot of buzz down in Champaign, maybe.
Great for recruitment.
Yeah, and then.
And to lose the way they did. I mean, Shannon Ryan covers the Illini for us at the Tribune, and actually she had this great tweet. Obviously, we're talking about Illinois losing to Eastern Michigan University, and she said, you know, aside from the outcome of the game, the most puzzling question I have is why EMU's mascot isn't an emu.
It is a bird, though, isn't it? The Eagles, I think.
I think it's the Eagles. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But, that's funny. I never realized that.
But Eastern Michigan winning on a last-minute field goal after Illinois had come back to tie up the game.
Right. Well, I mean, to
after leading the game.
Exactly. I mean, to cough up a 17-point lead right out of the gate, and that the MAC can be competitive, though.
Fun to watch. Yeah. I mean, obviously a disappointing day for Northern Illinois against Nebraska.
Yeah.
But the MAC is always fun and can always be dangerous. I mean, they just play more. I think they play more wide open. And they're definitely fun to watch. We should also probably, and Joe, to your heart, we should probably wish the new Midwest League champion.
Wow, you heard about that, huh?
Yes, the South Bend Cubs winning the championship.
So, you know, my first year in Kane County, we were affiliated with the Cubs. This
right.
was 2014, and they did the same thing. They swept through the playoffs, and they won the Midwest League championship. They won a total of 98 games that year, but you know the ironic thing? They beat the Indians affiliate for the championship that
season. Oh, how ironic
right?
that is. Wow.
South Bend Cubs sweeping the Midwest League championship, for those that don't catch the reference. They beat the Clinton Lumber Kings over at Nelson Court Field in beautiful Clinton, Iowa.
Clinton's a nice town.
Clinton's a fine, quaint, unique town.
Yeah, you don't necessarily want to stay there too
long.
No,
you don't. And sometimes I do have to stay there too long, so
yeah,
that's why.
I understand. Well, but there are some great little places along the Midwest League.
You know what? Clinton, Iowa has the best sandwich shop in the Midwest League, and it's right by our hotel. It's fantastic.
Really?
Yeah, it's called the Steam Anchor Cafe, and the place is flooded every time I go there.
What do you mean flooded?
Everyone's there.
Oh,
sorry.
I was thinking
not
river,
in a negative
river.
Way.
Yes,
they do have those problems
right,
time
right.
to time.
And what's the best sandwich?
It's called the Orchard Turkey. They cut thin slices of apple, and they put it in a like turkey, chipotle mayo, bacon, avocado, thinly sliced apple on a ciabatta panini. It's out of this world.
That sounds way too cultured for Clinton, Iowa. I got to tell you. Wow. Well, maybe that'll be part of the presidential road tripping.
There you go.
Who knows? Who knows?
You should check it out.
Well, thanks for the tip. Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Joe's got the latest sports, of course. Producer Cassara's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at symbol Sunday Spin, and engineer Bob is looking for his Blackhawk sweater. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com, and you can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break on this drizzly Sunday morning. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Up ahead on the show, after the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Constance Jones. She's the CEO of the Noble Network of Charter Schools, and we'll talk about the state of education and charter schools in Chicago. After the news and sports at the top of the hour, we'll speak to a good friend of the program, Jason DeSanto. He's a senior lecturer at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. We'll discuss Thursday night's debate among the Democratic presidential contenders. After a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, we'll speak to Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs. We'll discuss the latest legal issues surrounding the Sterigenics plant in suburban Willowbrook. That's all up ahead. Time for a quick break. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Some interesting news involving life in Washington. New York Times reporting this morning its investigation into Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's time at Yale University, uncovering another allegation of sexual misconduct that was previously unreported. And it was a allegation that was brought to the attention of U.S. senators and the FBI before his confirmation. But the FBI did not decide to investigate, according to the New York Times. You go from that to the fact that now you have Vice President Mike Pence claiming that he was bit by the championship horse, American Pharoah, during a visit, apparently trying to make it an allegorical that in our line of work, you're going to get bit sometimes, but you keep fighting forward. But now we have the head of the farm where American Pharoah is saying that story is highly doubtful. You got that. Then, of course, we had the news last week that the departure of the always controversial and the hawkish John Bolton from the Trump administration as national security advisor. And did he quit or was he fired? Does it matter? Here's President Trump.
John is somebody that I actually got along with very well. He made some very big mistakes when he talked about the Libyan model for Kim Jong-un. That was not a good statement to make. You just take a look at what happened with Gaddafi. That was not a good statement to make. And it set us back. And frankly, he wanted to do things not necessarily tougher than me. You know, John's known as a tough guy. He's so tough he got us into Iraq. That's tough. And but he's somebody that I actually had a very good relationship with. But he wasn't getting along with people in the administration that I consider very important. And I hope we've left in good stead, but maybe we haven't, maybe we haven't.
Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley of Chicago told CNN that he's glad John Bolton is gone, but given the president, Quigley says he has worries about what's next.
I'm glad John Bolton is gone, one of the chief architects of the Iraq war, the military first option, the unilateral action option, using questionable intelligence. Sure, I'm glad he's gone. But obviously two main concerns. First, it's hard to believe his successor won't be of the same cloth. And second, you mentioned this is the fourth national security advisor, second secretary of state, third chief of staff. It's a foreign policy in shambles anyway, but the lack of continuity certainly hurts.
That's Chicago Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley. Well, we're going to bring things a bit more local now, and joining me here in the WGN Skyline studio is Constance Jones. She's the CEO of the Noble Network of Charter Schools. Constance, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
I wanted to have you on because partly, you know, it is back to school time and that kind of thing. And also, you know, charters are always kind of in the news. And I guess, like, just right off the bat, what do you feel is the biggest misconception people have about charter schools?
Yes, there are lots of them. So I'm really grateful, Rick, for the opportunity to address them. So I can tell you that Noble, we are public charter schools. We are open enrollment schools. So what does that mean? That means that we accept all kids. As long as there is a seat, you can come and attend a Noble charter school and receive a top-notch, high-quality public school education. So that's one misconception out there. We receive public funding, and our charter simply allows us with certain autonomy to innovate and to really cultivate this experience to get our kids ready for college. And then the other one is that we take kids, we cream, you often hear the term creaming, and that one really strikes home because we pride ourselves on serving the kids who need it most throughout the city of Chicago. 98% of our kids are a minority, 89% of them qualify for free or reduced lunch, 18% of our kids are diverse learners, have IEPs, and so we as educators pour our hearts and souls into providing the kids throughout Chicago with a high quality education that prepares them for college, and it's something we're really proud of.
What about issues like special ed?
Yes. So 18% of our kids have IEPs or special education students, and that is a little bit higher than the district average for CPS. And so what that signals to me is that families feel very comfortable sending their kids with special needs to us because of our track record of providing great support for them.
How do you attract students or recruit students? How does that work?
Mm-hmm. So Noble's been around for 20 years.
Right.
We were founded in 1999, and we wouldn't exist today if families weren't demanding more high quality public school options for their kids. And we're really fortunate because when I think about why families come to us and what our parents tell us and our students tell us, it's because of things like our track record for growing kids academically. And so this study was recently released by MIT.
Don't jump ahead just yet.
Okay.
I want to come back to that a little bit.
That exciting news for later.
All right.
But we hear a lot about our focus on college. For example, traditionally, 99% of our kids are accepted into college. And of the class of 2019, our kids got $491 million in scholarships and grants. And so, again, for a population of students from under-resourced communities throughout the city, they have resources to go to college so we can eliminate that financial burden. And then we pride ourselves on providing a support system of love and high expectations. There's that high expectation that you're going to do well in our schools, and we know you can, and then providing our kids with the love and support so they can do that. And so that's ultimately why families select us, and we wouldn't exist if our families and our students didn't choose us every day.
What is the student population in the Noble charters?
Sure. So Noble has 18 schools, and we have 17 high schools. We serve over 12,000 students from all across Chicago, from Auburn, Gresham, Inglewood, North Lawndale, and other communities throughout the city. There are about 105,000 students, high school students in Chicago public schools. And so we make up roughly 11% of the entire CPS high school population.
And you have high schools as well as earlier,
we have one middle school in Grand Crossing that serves about 300 students, but the vast majority
are high school. But the focus is on high
school. Focus is on high school.
And why is that?
Yeah, so our founders were Chicago Public School high school teachers, and so they had the unique experience of seeing some of the challenges and the opportunities within high school. And I really appreciate the focus on high school, because high school can be very challenging for lots of reasons. Oftentimes, our kids come to us so far behind, and we have to catch them up within 3.5-4 years to get them ready for college. And so I appreciate the focus, because there's enough there for us to really spend time and attention on, and that we're allowed to do that.
So there's an issue of remediation that has to be looked at as far as the high school curricula is concerned.
Absolutely. Our teachers are amazing, and we just could not do this work without our hardworking teachers, and so I'm really grateful for everything that they do to get our kids caught up so they can go off and achieve their wildest dreams through college.
We're speaking with Candace Jones. She is the CEO of the Noble Network of Charter Schools. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the WGN Skyline studio, joined by Constance Jones. She is the CEO of Noble Network of Charter Schools. We're talking about Noble's charter schools, and we'll now go to the point you were going to make earlier about the study from MIT that basically says that selective enrollment high schools get a lot of attention, obviously, but that the Noble schools are right there in comparison.
Sure. So I'll just provide a little bit more feedback on the research study. So MIT economists basically found that Noble students grew more academically than their peers at selective enrollment schools. This is groundbreaking, game-changing news for the city of Chicago. As I mentioned earlier, Noble's been around for 20 years. We've gotten some incredible results throughout that 20 years related to our academic success and college success. And we pride ourselves on being a high-quality public school option for kids. The reality is that if you look at stats from 2018, about 30% of students who applied to select enrollment schools got in, and about less than half of them got their first choice. And I talk with students every day at Noble, many of them who applied to the select enrollment schools and didn't get in. And essentially, this study is saying that you're going to be served as well or better at a Noble school. And that is just what our kids deserve so much.
What is the challenge today in as far as with high school students with adjusting to the new world that we live in today? Mm-hmm. You know, you have people even questioning now about, you know, is a college education mm-hmm. worth today what it was mm-hmm. 10 years ago even? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. A lot of these folks who are like, oh, college is not for all, send kids to trade schools. I agree that students should have options and we need to support our kids on a path of their choice. And a lot of these people who are making those statements are sending their own kids to college. And so I'm like, well, why is it that our Black and brown kids from under-resourced communities, like, why shouldn't they have that same option? You know, we recently completed a strategic plan, and we surveyed over 1,500 of our students and our parents to really understand, as we think about the next chapter of Noble, how can we serve you? And we asked them specifically about this question around why they choose Noble. And 82% of our parents said they choose us because of the college focus, and 72% of our students said they choose us because of our college focus. So that says to me that college is incredibly important for Black and brown families across the city of Chicago, and then it is on us to then provide them with everything they can or need in order to be successful.
Well, and part of the reason I ask this too is because of just as we've seen, at least certainly among state supported colleges and universities, mm-hmm. just the lack of resources that they've gotten from state government, mm-hmm. some of them being almost starved to death, mm-hmm. and as a result, tuition, you know, massive tuition increases, student debt loads. Now, obviously, you talked about, you know, the successes you've had in being able to help students get scholarships to offset that. But just, I mean, there was never a time where people, I think, looked at college this way, mm-hmm. as in, is it really worth it?
Yeah. Well, it is certainly hard. And I come from the camp of, because it's hard doesn't mean that we should give up, especially if our students and families are telling us that this is what they want.
And I kind of agree with you that when you hear kind of the trade school option out there, everybody should have opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody should have opportunity.
Absolutely.
So let's not pigeonhole people into, you know, oh, well, you, I mean, this isn't the old English system of education here. It's everybody should have opportunity.
Yes, and they should have opportunity, and they should also have the support. So whether that is like the scholarships and grants that we work so hard every year to help our students secure $491 million, or when they get to college and then, like myself, like went to an all-Black high school and then ended up at a predominantly white university, and you experience that culture shock of, oh my gosh, like I'm one of a handful of students of color in this classroom, and you kind of feel like, do I deserve to be here? Well, we're really fortunate that we have alumni counselors at Noble that are checking in with our students once they graduate from Noble, like, how are you doing? Like, what do you need support? And just being accessible for our students to reach out to them when they encounter challenges. Like I said, 84% of our kids are going to be the first in their families to go off to college. And that can be very, very lonely. And it can also be very exciting, but we want to be there for them throughout the whole spectrum of feelings and the ups and downs and challenges.
Yeah, because they have no peers in their family to be able to, you know, bounce those kinds of ideas and concepts off of what they're going through.
Oftentimes they don't. So that's where we come in. I mean, you know, this work is very hard and is also the best work I could ever ask for. I was talking to a student just a week ago from the south side of Chicago African-American female. Tomorrow, she's on a one-way ticket out to San Francisco. She's going to Stanford University. She has a full ride. She'll be the first in her family to go to college. She traveled for 2 hours every day to get to this noble school on the Northwest Side that specializes in STEM. That is game-changing, life-changing, transformational work. And I have to believe that every child that I meet every day is capable of doing the same.
And you mentioned this being a young woman, mm-hmm. and the fact of more efforts to try to encourage women to get into STEM education. Mm-hmm. Isn't that, I mean, that's the trend, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities in STEM, and I'm personally committed to it because I had a father who was a farmer who went off to college and majored in statistics and was one of the few African-American males to be in that field and the first African-American male to receive his Master of Science in statistics from North Carolina State University. And so it's something that's very near and dear to me.
Statistics.
I know. Statistics is something
it's the
else.
Worst college class ever is statistics.
Yeah, I had to, I was a business major and I had to take a business statistics class and I will never forget it my sophomore year of college. But we survived and nevertheless, that type of training and preparation has helped me in so many ways. And there's, you know, so many jobs that our students can have access to when they major in those majors. And, you know, it's an opportunity for them to bring themselves out of poverty, their families, their communities. And so we're really just trying to do everything we can to provide our students with those opportunities.
That's Constance Jones. She's the CEO of Noble Network of Charter Schools. Constance, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. This was fun. Thank you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the WGN Skyline studio by my good friend Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. And we're going to talk about the Thursday night debate of the qualifying 10 Democratic presidential candidates. We still have another debate coming in October. But before we get into that discussion, I want to spend the next couple of minutes here just on kind of playing a little mashup of some of the highlights of that debate on Thursday night.
They're going to give back that money to the employee?
Matter of fact, they will.
Well, let me tell you something. For a socialist, you got a lot more confidence in corporate America than I do.
You got to defend the fact that today, not only do we have 87 million people uninsured and underinsured, you got to defend the fact that 500,000 Americans are going bankrupt. You know why they're going bankrupt? Because they suffered a terrible disease, cancer or heart disease. Under my legislation, people will not go into financial ruin because they suffered with a diagnosis of cancer. And our program is the only one that does that.
We know Donald Trump's a racist, but there is no red badge of courage for calling him that.
Houston, we have a problem. We have a guy there that is literally running our country like a game show. He would rather lie than lead.
President Trump, you've spent the last 2.5 years full time trying to sow hate and division among us. And that is why we've gotten nothing done. You have used hate, intimidation, fear, and over 12,000 lies as a way to distract from your failed policies and your broken promises. The only reason you've not been indicted is because there was a memo in the Department of Justice that says a sitting president cannot be charged with a crime.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
Congressman, thank you.
And I want to say this. I'm listening to the people of this country. The day after I proposed doing that, I went to a gun show in Conway, Arkansas, to to meet with those who are selling AR-15s and AK-47s and those who are buying those weapons. And you might be surprised, there was some common ground there. Folks who said, I would willingly give that up, cut it to pieces. I don't need this weapon to hunt, to defend myself. It is a weapon of war. So let's do the right thing, but let's bring everyone in America into the conversation. Republicans, Democrats, gun owners, and non-gun owners alike.
Can I make a point? Congressman, thank you. I want to bring a Senator.
I believe that what unites us up here, the 10 of us, is much stronger than what divides us. And I think that's true of our country, too.
He handled what happened in his hometown is meaningful. To look in the eyes of those people, to see those kids, to understand those parents, to understand the heartache.
But this is
the
problem.
We are ready to do this.
Mr. Vice President, thank you. You did bring.
You said they would have to buy in.
Have to buy in. If you qualify,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Automatically be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago? I mean, I can't believe that you said 2 minutes ago that they had to buy in, and now you're saying they don't have to buy. You're forgetting that.
So it was a lively forum.
It has to be for 3 hours. If it doesn't, by hour two and a half, America is no longer watching.
So one of the things I noted here is that you didn't hear from Elizabeth Warren.
Within those clips.
Within those clips, yes.
You certainly could have. She had a steady evening. She didn't have anything that you would consider a jump-out soundbite, but she operates on a very steady plane. She is, to some extent, hiding in plain sight. She gets an attack, she turns it away rather easily, and then just moves on to the next. And it's working very well for her as a debater and also in the campaign as a whole.
So you are an expert on rhetoric and political rhetoric and debate rhetoric. Who won, in your view?
I think there were, if we had 10 people on stage, you mentioned, yes. Rick, so I would say half of those people actually had an evening that was helpful to them.
Mm-hmm.
O'Rourke, Booker, Klobuchar, Warren, and Buttigieg. Those five, I think, did the best. I usually look at these things from a debate perspective on three polls. There are three things that I'm looking for. The first of those is simply, who on that stage was projecting some kind of core leadership attributes that people can very quickly form positive judgments about the person? Who do we like, and who seems like they're up to the job? And by that metric, I think it was a really good night for O'Rourke and for Booker. O'Rourke, for the first time, was able to actually deliver answers that were firm and that also were passionate, and mixed in a fair amount of issue fluency on guns and also on race.
Which kind of, that was what he hadn't been seen and had raised questions about. Is he just an empty suit?
It had really eluded him. And some of that was tonal. He just didn't have the kind of firmness you need in these settings to contrast yourself with other people and to kind of pass that stature test. And he had that. He also brought a great deal of passion, and also, particularly in his answer on race, numbers, facts, data, backed by a policy. Very well done. Booker, I think, in all of these, is fluent in the issues and is very warm. Seems like he's enjoying himself. Seems like somebody that you'd want to listen to talk about these subjects, and he seems to know what he's talking about. He did that again. So if we look at just in that way, by that metric, who really had a good night in terms of projecting those attributes, I think those two really did. The next thing that I would look at, the second, is who is really driving their message consistently, what they're in favor of, how that contrasts with other people on the stage. And there I thought it was Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren. Klobuchar, particularly on healthcare, I think was the most pointed, salient, and drove very quickly the contrast between her and some of the people who were more liberal in a way that Biden tried and did okay with, but I thought she was better at it.
Well, like to Bernie saying, I wrote the damn bill, and she said, I read the damn bill,
and it's not a bold idea, it's a bad idea. I think she occasionally lapses into the one-liner in a way that becomes a little
in an obvious way.
That, yeah, it, I don't think Houston, looks, we have a problem, is any longer something that is original,
right,
or fun.
Right, right.
Okay, that stopped in about 1999, so we can leave that behind. But she really was.
You know, she's from Minnesota. They just got dial-up, okay? So you have to give her a break.
She did a good job articulating policy. But we talked about Warren. This is where she is a success every time out. This time, from the opening bell, she really framed her candidacy on the idea of the middle class. And this is what we have been talking about in here time and time again, has been her ability to tie her own story to the middle class story. And in doing that, to take these things that some people perceive as being too radical or of the left and making them sound like this is the thing that's fundamentally broken in the economy that's hurting you in the middle class. And I understand that because that's what I came from. And to hitch that to all the things people always say about her, her plans and everything else. And she comes back to it constantly. That kind of discipline and doing it in a way with passion is effective. The one thing I didn't think she did as well, I thought she was a little less textured in her answers. There was a little bit less of the stories, the humor. Those things sort of dropped out a little bit. And that is the thing that provides her a degree of connection that when she's at her best, she's able to actually leverage. And she didn't really do that as well this time around, but she was very steady. The last thing, the third thing, do no harm. Did the candidate do something that really negatively impacted their candidacy? Usually, what happens in that case is they do something that reinforces some negative narrative that's out there about them. So in 2007, October 2007, when Hillary Clinton went to a debate in Philadelphia and waffled on a question about illegal immigrants and driver's license,
right,
it raised the question again of whether or not she was a politician of calculation, not conviction. Played into a negative stereotype. 2016, Marco Rubio gets called out on stage by Chris Christie for basically being somebody who was really good at rhetorical gambits and staying on message, but couldn't do anything beyond that. And then Rubio just repeated the same talking points. Right. Played right into it. Very damaging right before New Hampshire. By that metric, did anybody do themselves any harm that played into a negative narrative? I think the answer is no. The person who had the most to risk there was Biden. I think if you tuned in the last 90 minutes, you would have had some concerns in that regard. During that 90 minutes, he gave an answer on foreign policy, which was really rambling about Iraq, Afghanistan.
Hold right there, because we're going to need to take a break. Okay. But I want to come back to talk about the former vice president.
Yes.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, here with Jason DeSanto from the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. We'll be back in just... Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the WGN Skyline studio with Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, and we're talking about the Thursday night Democratic debate. And I didn't mean to cut you off there, Jason.
Oh, but, no.
You were beginning to sound like Joe Biden.
you mean the Joe Biden of the first 90 minutes or the last 90 minutes of the debate?
Well, look, now, well, let's... I think you're absolutely right.
Rick, are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago? I can't believe you're forgetting.
Let me go and listen to it on my record player, okay? What the heck was that? I mean, I understand the point he was trying to make about children who listen and get a better vocabulary, do better.
Yeah.
But play the record player?
Well, it was all very frantic. That
it was.
It was very frantic. It was as though... The question started off being a question of...
I don't even remember what the question was.
Well, I watched it several times to go back to the beginning, because it was a real travelogue. The answer, it started with inequality in education, the question itself. Then it kind of moved towards more of a general inequality question. So the question itself was not...
Focused.
Focused and artful in some ways, but certainly there was a ballpark that one could have landed in. And then there was the more general neighborhood, and then there was the city itself, and Biden was sort of out in the suburbs with the answer. He was gravitating. At one point,
I think he was circling the planet, actually.
I think at some point in that answer, he was able to discuss the merits of the keto diet, the benefits of the Chevy Impala, the average temperature in Belize. Now, I'm making these things up, but it was a little all over the place. And I think it was because he was frantic to give an answer that was better than the answer he gave on busing in the first debate with Kamala Harris.
Right.
And in the process of doing that, you know, he he started talking about, you know, people playing a record player, and then also, you know, implying at some level that people need help raising their kids because they might not know how to raise their kids, and so the implication, you know, there some people took from it is, oh, well, which audiences are those? They can't raise their children. So he really created some difficulties for himself. If you watched in the first 90 minutes, I thought he was much sharper and really engaged the debate on health care in a pretty effective way against Sanders and Warren. He just seemed to lose his way towards the end of the debate. So if we think about doing no harm, there was some harm at the end, but not so much at the beginning, and it's probably a draw.
Did Julian Castro do harm with his rejoinder to Biden?
Well, he certainly got pushback on it. Yes. I mean, if his goal was to reinforce the fact that Joe doesn't seem all the time to be as sharp as he could be or used to be, then he succeeded, but he probably didn't help his own campaign very much in saying what he said. And there was a little confusion about what he was trying to nail Biden on as something Biden actually said. I went back and I listened to several portions of the debate to try to see. He was calling Biden out for saying that you would that in Biden's plan you'd have to enroll in Medicare for All or the public option, whereas in Castro's plan you were automatically be enrolled. If you look back at what Biden said, at one point he said buy in, at one point he said automatically enroll. There was enough there for Castro to make a point.
To raise a criticism.
Yeah, to raise a criticism, at least as to a lack of clarity in the plan. But to drive it and reinforce it the way he did didn't do himself any favors.
What dynamic from this do we look for in the next debate? Is it still a matter of trying to? I still think it's a differentiation game.
I think it's a differentiation game. We saw the beginnings of that debate about health care front and center at the beginning. Buttigieg tried to interject that there was too much back and forth about whose plan does what. My take on it, although I thought that Mayor Pete was really effective in the second half of the debate.
Well, particularly his closing.
His closing, which was truly artful and sincere. But in the opening part of the debate, that was, I think, mistimed, because I think if you're actually listening to the debate that people were having at that point about health care, it was a substantive debate.
Right.
About what the better way forward
is. Yeah, this wasn't name-calling or anything like that. It was talking about actual specific elements of health care.
Yeah, and so we're going to get more of that. We're going to get more of that in differentiation. We're going to get more of Klobuchar, Booker, Buttigieg, sounding notes of unity to try to basically be there behind Biden in case Biden falls away, which to me, again, makes it the question of how much does Biden show and how does he show it? And to some extent, how durable is his support? Is it the kind of support that where people are willing to excuse a series of odd statements like record player or not? So far, the answer seems to be yes. And so as we get to October, I think that'll be the next iteration of that set of questions.
And I mean, as we were saying off the air, it's almost like in some respects an opposite or a counter to Trump and his supporters
in that it's durable, where people are willing, they think they know who the person is so much that whatever they do plays into the preconception of who the person is. Now the difference is that Joe Biden has 40 years in public life by which to be judged. 40 years as a consoler, 40 years of going through a lot of personal struggle and heartache in a way that people feel like they can identify with that. And I would contrast that a little bit with what Trump presents versus who Trump really is.
Sure.
I'm certain I bring my own bias to that question, but I think it's a well-founded one.
Absolutely. Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, thank you so much for joining me. I hope we can do this next month with following that debate.
We'd love
to
do it, Rick. Thank you.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Just want a personal note. I want to congratulate my one time, let's see, he was at the Sun-Times, then he was at the University of Illinois Springfield, where he ran the public affairs reporting class for 26 years. My good friend Charlie Wheeler, Charles N. Wheeler III, if you're familiar with the byline, who is retiring. And last night there was a gathering of the alumna of the public affairs reporting program at the University of Illinois in Springfield. Unfortunately, it was past my bedtime. I would have loved to have gone, but over 200 PAR graduates from across the country attended to honor Charlie for all of his leadership in that program. And so just want to wish him well in his retirement, which doesn't necessarily stop me from calling him for quotes for stories. So want him to remember that. Well, joining me now here in the WGN Skyline studio is Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin from Western Springs. Leader Durkin, thank you again for coming into the studio.
Good morning, Rick. Great to see you. And skies are opening up and
they're clearing, not clearing. Opening up. It makes it sound like it's more rain coming. It'll be a fine day. It'll be humid.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
So I wanted to talk to you about the issue of Sterigenics. And the story confounds me because, and frankly, it was Mike Cawthorn, my great colleague at the Tribune, environmental writer, who really brought this issue to the fore about the issue of the ethylene oxide cancer-causing emissions from the Sterigenics plant. So a lot of outrage. There's legislation. A law is passed. Then there's a consent decree. And then now you have new legislation that you've proposed. You have the governor saying, Governor Pritzker, who signed the original legislation, saying, well, if you got something better, we'll bring it back and we'll go into special session. Never happened. What the heck is going on?
There's a lot of moving parts on this issue, but I think just going back to how this all started, and I think for people who are still trying to figure out this Sterigenics issue, it was a little more than a year ago, maybe when the U.S. EPA, a division in the U.S. EPA called, it's they go by ATSDR. I forgot exactly what that means, but they produced a report stating that they said that ethylene oxide is more dangerous than they previously had thought. And that in particular areas, and one specifically in Willowbrook, because of the emissions that they had detected at the Sterigenics facility, it could cause serious bodily injuries and different types of infirmities and illnesses over a period of time if it is not contained properly. It sent off a shockwave in the western suburbs, and I immediately was whistled in by the mayor of Willowbrook, Frank Trilla, it was very difficult and trying to figure out what to do, what does this mean? Within a few weeks, there was a public hearing, and then the lines of individuals who lived in that area had talked about their illnesses, their cancers, their tumors, leukemias that they have either are currently experiencing or people in their family have experienced who have lived in that region for decades. And Sterigenics has been in Willowbrook for some 20, 30 years, and before that it was Griffith Labs. But ethylene oxide is a product that has been around for a while, and it's used in the sterilization of a lot of products in the manufacturing side, but also in the healthcare industry, particularly for hospitals, for surgical kits, which they sterilize, and that is what they traditionally have used it for. But it's the emissions of the ethylene oxide into the environment is what has caused the great concerns, and which has led to some 30 or 40 personal injury lawsuits.
Right, a number of lawsuits.
And now those are ongoing. Those will go on forever. And because of I would guess from the comments from the U.S. EPA is that, well, you know, we're going to have to go look at ethylene oxide again because our new analysis shows that it's much more powerful and more toxic than we thought it was when it was previously analyzed years ago. So, all right, do something, U.S. EPA. They haven't. So that's prompted us in Springfield, based on this great concern, this health concern. It's just not only the health, but people can't. Their neighborhood, their kids, right. They're afraid to have their kids walk around the neighborhoods without having some type of covering over their mouth. They can't sell their homes. The property values are really challenging over there. People are looking for some type of response. And I during the course of this, there was a gentleman by the name of Matt Haller who lived about a half a mile from my office. And my office is literally is about a mile away from the Sterigenics facility, and my home is 4 miles away. Matt Haller is mutual friends with my family, and he says, I need to talk to you. He came in extremely, extremely ill. He was in his last days. He had a very, very advanced case of stomach cancer, and it was very sad, and he talked to me about his experience. He was the first plaintiff that filed the lawsuit, but he didn't have a lot of time, and he mm-hmm. discussed the situation that was going through him and his wife and his young son. It was a very, very sad moment, but he told me that, you know, please do something about this. Make sure that this doesn't happen to anybody else, what's going on with me. And he personally asked me that, could you please name this after me so I don't, my life means something, that people will remember this and that we're going to do something about ethylene oxide. But he specifically told me, I said, do you want this banned? He goes, no, don't ban it because I know it's used in different processes. It's important in the manufacturing process for sterilization, but there are bad actors out there, and do something about this. So I passed the Matt Haller Act, which puts great restrictions for the first time anywhere in the nation on sterilization facilities such as Sterigenics and how they operate and how they control their emissions. And we did it also with a higher standards, continuous emissions monitoring. We forced, the most comprehensive set of emission standards for anywhere in the United States, in which you have to capture 99% of the emissions, a long list of things which I worked on with my colleague, Dan Mazzocchi, who's an intellectual property lawyer who knows molecules and little things like that. She was fantastic and a great help with this. We did that because we also knew at the time, which prompted this, was action by the Illinois EPA last year, which was under the new Pritzker administration, where a seal order was placed on the doors of Sterigenics in Willowbrook stating that they caused a public health and safety concern. And because of that, the EPA has this authority to stop the facility from operating. Some people have questioned whether or not there was sufficient facts and evidence at the time for the EPA to do that. I sustain that there was.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break, and we're going to pick up the rest of the story when we come back. We're speaking with Jim Durkin, the Republican leader of the Illinois House. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with Jim Durkin, the Illinois House Republican leader from Western Springs. We're talking about the issue of the Sterigenics plant, the ethylene oxide emitting plant in Willowbrook. And so we had this legislation that was passed, signed into law.
That's correct.
Then we have a consent decree that's reached between Sterigenics, the Illinois Attorney General's office, and the DuPage County State's Attorney's office.
That's correct.
Where does that fit in?
Where does that fit in? The consent decree lifts the seal order that was issued by the Illinois EPA back at the end of the year.
Okay.
And that's I opposed the consent decree. I felt that the municipalities who at the last minute said we need to have more participation in this, and I supported that, but they entered into the decree about 2 weeks ago. Now, at the same time, just before that, which has prompted a lot of concern, is that the Sterigenics facility had submitted about a month and a half ago a permit for construction, a new construction permit, saying that we're going to comply with the new law and we're going to go above and beyond.
With your law that puts almost unattainable
correct
standards.
It is. And there was a public hearing done about a month ago, another one, in which EPA attended, and we went through that permitting process also. We went through their permit, and we dissected it, and we punched so many holes in it, myself, my colleagues, and residents, where there is sufficient basis for the Illinois EPA to say no to that permit. And I contend that if the EPA does what they should be doing instead of being a rubber stamp, this whole issue of legislation could be a moot issue, and they should say no. So right now, it's a very confusing process. But the fact is, the people of that area are not, they don't care about process. They want that facility shut down, and so do I.
Okay, so you have legislation, new legislation
to say that because I was not happy with the way that the consent decree went down, because the municipalities did not have the ability to
have a say,
this legislation is going to state that a home rule municipality that has a sterilization facility that emits EO, that the village can, by ordinance, ban it, like villages can do. They can ban alcohol sales, they can ban tobacco sales, they can ban strip clubs, because they believe it's in the best interest of their residents and it complies with the health and welfare of their citizens. And that is what I am attempting to do.
I understand that you're putting EO on par with, you know, products, that kind
Correct.
Of thing. But is it ex post facto because that this plant had been operating?
No. I mean, we're going to get into constitutional questions about takings.
Yes.
Every step of the way I've looked at that. I'm not concerned. If we were going to say that we just can't shut down that facility by just passing law.
By decreeing it.
But it doesn't say that they can't use an alternative at that facility other than EO. We're just saying we're banning EO. We believe that there are safer sterilization products in commerce that can be used to achieve the same goals. So we're just saying that this specific gas that has been determined by the US EPA to be even more toxic and dangerous than we ever thought, use something else. But you know what? I've talked to so many people in that area, and you just can't say that it's environmental conditions that's causing these terrible tragedies and illnesses. At the end of the day, all factors and all fingers go towards all people. It goes back to Sterigenics. I know that area very well, and that is the common denominator with all these lawsuits, and I just hope that we can reach a conclusion. I would hope that Sterigenics would understand that, you know what, you're not wanted. Find an alternative or leave the area, because I think it's going to be very difficult for them to be able to, comply or just to satisfy their business model, because it's just not going to work out there anymore.
So the legislation, the new legislation, are expectations of action in the veto session?
I've had a discussion with the governor, and without getting too deep into it, he indicated that this is something that he thinks it's a step in the right direction, and I'll continue to work on it. I'm hopeful to have a public hearing within the next 2 weeks, a subject matter hearing of some sort, before one of the House committees on that, so we can walk into the veto session prepared to move forward. It is my goal for the veto session is to get that bill passed and get it on the governor's desk for him to sign, to give that local option to municipalities to say whether or not they want that type of product to be used within the four corners of their village.
All right. We will be watching that very closely. Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin from Western Springs, thank you so much for joining me this morning.